Hello, welcome to the EI podcast. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Andrew Lambert, who is Lawton Professor of Naval History at King's College London, one of our most distinguished naval historians, and he has a new book out called No More Napoleons: How Britain Managed Europe from Waterloo to World War I. Now, that's quite a topic, Andrew. I wonder if we might look at the roots of the ideas that are being discussed in this book, because we're essentially, just for the readers and the listeners, we're looking about the period 1815, obviously the end of the Napoleonic Wars, to the beginning of the First World War in 1914. So it's just short of a century, a numerical century. And the prompting of the ideas of British statecraft, of British diplomacy, are forged as a reaction to, first of all, the French Revolutionary Wars, and then their extension with Napoleon. And that represents an incredible logistical and ideological challenge.
Yeah, the British state emerges fighting relatively limited wars on the margins of Europe. It profits from Europe's confusion as the Europeans fight about which particular Catholic monarch is more important than some other Catholic monarch, and small provinces somewhere on either side of the Rhine. The British are hoovering up global trade. They're hoovering up a global empire. They're removing rivals from the imperial extra-European space.
So we're talking about India here, West Indies, America?
The British come to dominate America by 1763. They've kicked the French out of Canada. They've controlled the West Indies. They're in a position to stop Spain's trade with the Americas. They capture Havana in 1763. Mm. They also capture Manila and hold it for ransom. So they become a global maritime phenomenon, which is entirely asymmetric with the European powers, particularly France, which is often trying to compete at sea. But if you're the King of France, you have a big border to the south and you have a big border to the east, and those are your priorities.
And you need an army, a substantial army.
The army has to come first in France, and it always will, because it's on the continent and it has neighbours who have big armies. So while we're looking at limited wars, wars in which the object is the exchange of territories, privileges, influence, the British can hover off, they can interfere in the wars with money, with diplomacy, with naval power, with small armies. But when we get to 1793, everything changes. This is a total war. Regimes are being demolished at a rapid rate. Mm. First the French regime, then control of what we now call Belgium, the Dutch Republic, into Germany, across the Rhine, into northern Italy. All of a sudden, France has gone from being a powerful continental European state to being a European imperial state. And the Roman Republic is the model of Republican France. Mm. If you look at Jacques-Louis David's great picture of the Horatii taking the oath, these are Roman Republican virtues, and their iconography follows that. They're saying, we are the new virtuous republic. We're going to sweep away all of these old things, which includes constitutional monarchies in England. Mm. And they very quickly realize that England is going to be a problem because they can't invade it without winning at sea. They can't win at sea because they've actually destroyed their navy's officer cadre. They're not going to win that. So they will just concentrate in Europe and exclude the British from Europe and mass power out of Europe to attack the British. And they will undermine them ideologically as well as militarily. So this is an existential threat. And Bourbon France threatened Britain's power, Republican France threatens Britain's existence. And so we get this step up. And at the middle of all of this is Prime Minister Pitt the Younger, a very young but very professional politician who is thinking long term and raising a cadre of brilliant young men who are going to take the British state through this war and into the peace.
And can we look at something about the ideology, if we can call it that, that Britain has there? Obviously, Pitt is crucial to this period, but there are other significant figures who are associated with this period, Castlereagh, I suppose, foremost among them, but also strategists, Nelson, absolutely, and then a person you might call the hero of your book, Wellington, with this idea of offshore balance. I wonder if we could look through the genealogy of what the ideology is that opposes revolutionary France.
For some of British leaders in this war, Nelson is a very good object to study here. It's about preserving the constitution, mixed constitution, constitutional monarch, parliament, bicameral legislature, the structures, the faith. He's a son of the church. Yep. He grew up in the Navy. Those are two things which are axiomatic to how the British view this war.
And he's a vociferous Tory as well, isn't he, Nelson?
Nelson is very much on the conservative side of politics. He's not retrograde, but he is certainly not in favour of radical change. Pitt is in favour of radical change, although he is a Tory, but these are changes that will make Britain stronger, more successful. And he is responsible for raising this whole group of people who are going to follow after his death in 1806. They're going to take up the reins. And with Wellington, that goes right through to 1852. So we get nearly 40 years worth of service out of these people. They are by turns. Wellington is a soldier who ends up as a political secretary to the Irish government and then goes back to being a soldier. He then becomes a diplomat. He signs the final act of the Congress of Vienna. He then becomes a soldier again. He has to fight a great battle. And for the rest of his life, he is balancing politics, diplomacy, strategy in a really quite striking way. And I think we underestimate Wellington off the battlefield, much as we're inclined to overestimate him perhaps on the battlefield. And then we come to people like Castlereagh and Robert Banks Jenkinson, Lord Liverpool, the Prime Minister who finished the war and took Britain into the next phase. Liverpool he's a Brexiteer. He wants out of Europe. He sees Europe as something which can be stabilised, monitored.
I think you use the phrase a problem to be managed.
It has to be managed. A Europe dominated by an imperial French regime is axiomatically threatening to Britain, you know, fundamentally so. If that French Empire includes what we now would now call Belgium, that's where the threat comes from.
And this is very interesting, this threat, because you're very specific about this, about the River Scheldt is the absolute key. This is the area around Antwerp in Belgium that is absolutely crucial to any designs, however likely or not, the French or any other continental power have to invade Britain or to threaten Britain.
Yeah. So what the French do from the early 1790s onwards is once they're in Belgium, they start to talk about an invasion. The Scheldt estuary, which is a very large body of water, is the one place on the northwest coast of Europe where you can park a lot of big sailing ships without the Royal Navy being able to sail in and attack them. So it's a secure place. And Napoleon will then build a big new dockyard at Antwerp to build and maintain the fleet there. The object of that fleet ultimately is not to invade England. The French won't take that risk. They would need 100,000 plus men. And if they lose them, which they almost certainly would, that's probably going to be the excuse for everybody else to pile in and attack France. The French are using it as a diversion, as a deterrent, as a means of coercing Britain. So a fleet in the Scheldt. And remember, 1588, that's where the Spanish are going to pick up their army. The Armada comes from Lisbon, but they're going into the Scheldt to pick up their army and then invade England. So it's been an existential threat. So for the British, getting the French out of Belgium is number one war aim. Everything else sort of fits around that. And the people who understand this are quite an odd collection. This is where Castlereagh comes in. Castlereagh is Secretary of State for War in Pitt's government in the early stages of the Napoleonic phase of the war. When Nelson comes back from his West Indies campaign, where he drives the enemy out of the Caribbean, he goes to the War Office to talk to Castlereagh. In the anteroom, he meets Wellington, who he knows all about because he's been reading the newspaper.
I'd love to have been there.
And the two of them then have a conversation. Wellington, in the 1830s, this is now the hero of Waterloo and Prime Minister, et cetera, says, I'm not sure I ever had a conversation that so fascinated me. What they're talking about is the emigre French general Charles de Maurier, who was obliged to leave the Republic by the radicals who wanted to cut his head off. Nelson had picked him up in North Germany and realized that he was a very superior military thinker, brought him back to England, got him on the English payroll, where he remained for the rest of his life. And Dumouriez was responsible for the early French planning of an invasion of England, and now he's responsible for the English defense against an invasion. And he says to Castlereagh, look, if you sit on the defensive, they will pin you down. You've got to seize the initiative. You've got to counterattack. And the place to counterattack is in the Scheldt. In 1801, Nelson is planning to go into the Scheldt just as the Revolutionary War ends. And he's got William Bligh drawing the charts for him. So he understands this. Castlereagh understands this. All they need is a competent soldier to lead the troops who will do the land fighting. So Nelson's plan is, let's finish the enemy at what turns out to be the Battle of Trafalgar, and then we'll come back and sort this threat out, and then we will be free of European threats. We control the Mediterranean. We've removed the threat of an invasion. They can't even hold that over us as a menace. We're in a much better position. So it's about strategic adjustment through targeted operations. So the object of these campaigns is to remove the ability of France to threaten Britain, leading up to what would almost certainly have to be some kind of negotiation.
And how does this work in the defeat of Napoleon ultimately in 1815?
So this is the game plan that the British take into the rest of the war. 1805, Austerlitz. By 1807, we've had Jena, Auerstadt, we've had Eylau. Napoleon is the master of the whole of Europe. He's dictated peace to the Russians. He now sets up his grand strategy, which is continental system, essentially an economic blockade of England, which would take in important things like food, but also all of the naval stores that are essential to build and maintain not only the navy, but also a global merchant marine. Mm. So the economic basis of British power, the military basis of British power would be undermined. That leads to 1807, the attack on Copenhagen, when the Danish navy is removed.
Mm. And the Baltic's very important to the Royal Navy, isn't it?
You can't run the sailing navy without the Baltic. Mm. You have to have access. It's timber, it's pitch, tar, it's hemp, flax, pig iron for ballast. It's all coming out of the Baltic. So the British are going to fight for the Baltic. They take the Danish navy away. They open up the Baltic. They continue trading all around the Baltic, even with Russia, which is at war with them because the Russians can't do without the money. There's a rather contemporary resonance here. And what they do is they gradually increase the pressure on Russia. And remember, Russia at this period, from 1809 onward, owns Finland, all of the Baltic states, more than half of Poland. Russia is a very big Baltic player, and the British are able to force the Russians back into their harbors to break their economy. And by 1811, the Russian economy is broken, and they abandon the alliance with Napoleon and accept that they will have to fight. But they will fight in Russia, not in Poland. Mm. And they eventually fight that battle right outside Moscow. But that's what the British are winning with, is economic pressure. You don't win the Napoleonic Wars at Trafalgar. You win with the aftermath, which is the economic crushing of the French Empire. Mm. You're putting more and more pressure on the French economy, which in turn is putting more and more pressure on the subject nations to cough up the resources, human, material, financial. And ultimately, that pressure breaks. It breaks with Russia. When Russia is successful, then the Prussians join in. Other German states join in. Sweden changes sides. And eventually, the Austrians come off the fence and join in and finish the job.
And we're at Waterloo by then.
This is before Waterloo. The 1814 peace, which the British contribute to by invading France before everybody else. Mm. Wellington's army crosses the Pyrenees before the Allies can break into France. As soon as Napoleon abdicates, Wellington is made ambassador in Paris to oversee a process which the British want stable national boundaries, France, outside Belgium. And it's Wellington's job to set up the defenses of Belgium in 1814. And in September 1814, the negotiations are happening in Vienna to create a European system. And the British are essentially playing both sides against the middle to create a stable system. Wellington is riding through Belgium, and he's identifying where the forts should be built. And he's also picking up on the battlefields that the Duke of Marlborough inspected in his time. One of them is Waterloo.
Yeah.
Marlborough in 1705 is marching north towards Brussels he sees the battlefield at Waterloo and decides that it's a terrible battlefield to fight from the south advancing on Brussels, and he outflanks it. Napoleon, who didn't have Marlborough's genius for picking terrain, doesn't see that. Wellington does. So Wellington picks the battlefield out in September 1814. It's right on the main road. It's exactly where he's anticipating this attack coming. It's endorsed by Marlborough. It really is the perfect battlefield. So his job is to stop this happening. But when it does happen, what he's doing is the template for how Britain would have responded to a French invasion of Belgium at any stage between 1814 and 1914. Of course, in 1914, it's not the French who invade Belgium, but Wellington is doing this not as a general. He's doing this as a statesman. He's essentially a cabinet minister who's on detachment. He's replaced Castlereagh at the Vienna Congress. He signs the final act. It's mostly Castlereagh's work, but he's the man on the spot who puts his name. And his stature, even in 1814, is very significant. His reputation as a soldier lends more kudos to what he says at Vienna than Castlereagh, who clearly is just a mere politician.
I get the sense with reading this book that you think, and you've already implied this, that Wellington is underrated in some sense, particularly as a statesman and a diplomat, as a creator of this stable European system. Why do you think that is?
The problem with Wellington is, after Waterloo, what else could you possibly do that would be more significant? Yeah. The answer, of course, is that Waterloo isn't actually that significant. You know, he was always going to win that battle.
Because everyone had turned against Napoleon.
And more importantly, he's picked a battlefield where he can't lose. Yeah.
I mean, is it really that?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. The sat is extraordinary. And it's extraordinary that when you think about the idea of Napoleon as this military genius, that he didn't realise that.
Well,
or did he?
There's something that Wellington says just after the battle. He said, "I was really disappointed with Boney." He said, "They just kept on coming like they always did. There was nothing new in Napoleon's tactics. There was nothing unexpected. There was a heavy artillery bombardment. There were then cavalry attacks, infantry attacks, more cannon fire." But Wellington had already neutralized this in 1807 in the peninsula when he put his men on a reverse slope so they couldn't be subject to direct cannon fire. Mm. It's really simple. His army wasn't a particularly good army. This wasn't his peninsular army. This was whatever he could grab. A lot of it came from the garrison of Ireland. Other bits were regiments that had been reinforced with militiamen. So he needed a good, strong defensive position, and he needed the Prussians to turn up. And his confidence that they would, and his confidence in the position, meant that he was able to hold that position until the Prussians arrived. His object was the annihilation of Napoleon's army, which he achieved. He then immediately stopped being a general, and he put the King of France back in his carriage, went back to Paris, put everything back together again, and added a few tweaks to make it even more suitable for the British. So this ability Wellington has to take the red jacket off, everybody thinks about Waterloo, and they think that's the pinnacle of everything. It isn't. He is a servant of the state till the day he dies. Only a few days before he died, he's still in the House of Lords passing critical strategic legislation.
And he lives to a great age as well.
So he transitions us from one age to another. You know, by the time he dies, he's this sort of almost deified figure. And his reputation suffers from Waterloo because everybody thinks that's the pinnacle of his achievement. He goes on to be prime minister. It's Wellington who sets up the process that leads to an independent Belgian state under the Treaty of London. He makes sure those negotiations are held in London, not anywhere else. It's a British treaty, not anybody else's treaty. Palmerston finishes it, but Wellington starts it. In 1840, the system he set up where the British are not in Europe but are ready to join in a European war if necessary with an expeditionary force is called out. The French threaten to cross the Rhine and invade Germany. The King of Prussia, who's new on the throne, is so spooked by this, he immediately gives Wellington command of the Prussian army. And because nothing happens, everybody forgets about this, but this is serious. It's got a diplomatic history trail. Nobody's ever bothered to follow it because nothing happened. Well, actually, it tells more about the long history of the 19th century than anything else. When push came to shove, the Germans wanted the British to take command of their army. They expected Wellington to bring 25,000 troops with him. They were going to put 200,000 in the field. So Wellington is this figure who dominates European responses to French aggression, and post-Napoleonic France is profoundly unstable. The possibility of a revolutionary outbreak or just some incompetent business by one of the many kings and other mountebanks who rule France in the early first half of the 19th century, that's what you need. And the whole point of being offshore is that being onshore is expensive and it annoys the French. So by withdrawing, the British are able to keep on fairly good terms with France. They're able to start to deal with this enormous debt burden they've incurred fighting for 20-odd years in what is essentially a total war. And they've got some domestic reforms to get through there. There's a whole back catalogue of things that need to be done. Wellington and the other Tory ministers are not opposed to reform. They're just not in a hurry to push through radical change. So Wellington himself introduces double-entry bookkeeping to the Army and the Navy. So you can actually look at the accounts and work out where all the money went. Before that, it was fairly random. Mm. So he's in charge of modernizing the state. He's in charge of increasing access to information. And he's overseeing a period in which Britain starts a whole new phase of massive strategic engineering projects, which are critical because we've got some new technology coming along. We have steamships. And all of a sudden, you need places where you can park your steamship and refuel it. And we don't have those on the south coast of England. So we need to start thinking about where the new naval bases will be. We need to speed up communications with Ireland because that's where you get a lot of your troops for your expeditionary force to go to Europe. So you build a huge new harbour at Holyhead on the north coast of Wales. You build a massive harbour in Dublin Bay at Dunleary. And that means you can get information to Dublin from London in only half the time. And you can move large bodies of troops much more quickly. And they're even using the canal network to move troops from the north of England to London and back. So you're engineering security. Then you build the huge harbour at Dover, which is one of Wellington's pet projects. He's the Lord Warden of the Cinque Ports. He lives at Walmer Castle. He can see this thing. He's riding down there frequently. There was some damage in the storm, and he was straight down there to see what was happening. And he was enormously pleased when it was open for business and you could start to operate steamships out of this harbour. Dover wasn't built for cross-channel traffic. It was built as a fleet base. And its peacetime use meant that the Navy didn't bother to use it. But as soon as war breaks out in 1914, the Navy takes it over because it was built for the Navy. You could put a whole battle fleet in Dover Harbour.
I was struck by, we were talking earlier about the resonance that this has now. When I think of a lot of conversations that are about state capacity, are about defence of the realm, are about priorities of the state, we're not really talking about the same thing, are we here? Because there's really not that much that the state does at this point. Certainly the first half of the 19th century, certainly around 1815, the state's role is limited, to say the least. And it's essentially about getting debt down, if anything.
That's absolutely right. The variable in British government expenditure is defence. You only have two armed services. If you cut them both down, that's a major saving. Yeah. So what you find is the army is reduced because it's a manpower intensive force. The Navy has its manpower reduced, but it has its dockyards rebuilt, it has its battle fleet reconstructed. Massive technological change in the first 20 years after the end of the war. Again, almost completely unobserved because the ships are basically the same. They're just bigger and better, and they're much more durable.
And artillery matters as well, doesn't it?
Better cannon, improved means of working with artillery, leading up to rifled artillery by the middle of the period. The one thing that has to be done is to pay down the national debt, because that's the indicator of government probity. If the City of London can sniff that the government is not going to pay the interest on the national debt, everything changes very quickly. And the link between the City of London and Parliament is as close as it's humanly possible. And these men are operating in very similar circumstances. So Lord Liverpool, Prime Minister from 1812 to 1827, 15 years of really hard slog. And then he has a massive seizure and he's disabled. One of his greatest interests is art. And he uses a windfall repayment of a loan to the Austrians to build the National Gallery. But the contents of the National Gallery belong to a City of London merchant called John Julius Angerstein, who had left the collection to the nation. Angerstein was the organizing genius of the Lloyd's Patriotic Fund that provided rewards, incentives, and pensions for distinguished service in the Navy and indeed in the Army. So we're looking at a much more closely integrated state with much more limited horizons in terms of what it was responsible for. And it was able to make choices which modern governments would find much more difficult. They're constrained by the sheer variety of pressures. Yeah. Every day there is some new thing that needs more funding. Mm. These things don't exist. So they're able to prioritize and identify what's necessary much more easily.
And I wonder, we've talked a lot about Europe, obviously, this idea of a settled Europe, Wellington's vision, the post-Vienna vision of a stable Europe. What is Britain doing in the rest of the world here? How is it benefiting globally from its settlement of Europe?
What Castlereagh and Liverpool identify early on in the move towards peace, 1813-14, that France and Russia are the two powers that Britain has to be concerned by. They're both imperial powers. They both have extra-European empires, and they have ambition to be greater than they are at the present. And Castlereagh famously says, look, the only real threat we face is the alliance of France and Russia. They have the second and third largest navies in the world. They're both hostile. They've both been at war with Britain in the very recent past. We have areas where we clash with them. So we need to be in the middle of that. And fortunately, for most of the period, French regimes were either unpopular in Russia or downright abhorred. So the Franco-Russian thing doesn't really get going until the 1880s, 90s. Mm.
And there's a general mistrust of France anyway as a Republican, or often a Republican polity.
The big problem with France, and Wellington makes this very clear, is whoever's governing it, it's not stable. The restored Bourbons are the least worst option. Charles X, who Wellington knows very well, he's hopeless. And all of those French regimes are convinced that what the French people want is glory and conquest and empire. And of course, after the Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars, most people in France want peace and quiet. They don't want their taxes going up, and they don't want to pay the tax of war, which is the blood of their sons. Mm-hmm. The average Frenchman had no interest in war or glory. The people who overthrew the Bourbons, the Orléans dynasty, and even the Third Republic, they're not interested in war and glory. They're interested in positive things. Mm-hmm. And these are domestic things. So we have a French regime problem where the French are constantly pushing projects which are about glory, and many of them are Napoleonic. Napoleon gets dragged into this over and over again. They can't even leave him on St. Helena. They drag him back to Paris. Mm-hmm. And he arrives just after they've been royally humiliated in the Eastern Mediterranean crisis. Mm. And they don't know what to do with him. It's embarrassing. We're talking about glory here, and we've just backed out of going to war in the most inglorious way imaginable. And the regime that did this never recovered. You know, their public esteem. Daumier's caricatures of Louis-Philippe, the elected king, were eviscerating. They made most of the worst of British caricaturing look really quite tame. He was portrayed as a pear because he was a somewhat stout fellow and mocked endlessly, and there was nothing he could do about it. Mm. So we've got a regime which is unstable. We've got a country where regime change is frequent.
Yep.
1830, 1848, 1852, 1873, and it's just endless. So that's a problem. France has the resources to be a nuisance, and the Belgium question is really big. So when Wellington sets up the idea of a neutral, guaranteed, independent Belgium,
in the 1830s,
with all the great powers guaranteeing the integrity and the independence of Belgium, that's a big, big thing. Mm. And it takes 9 years to get the Europeans to agree to this. So it's no easy business, but it is done. And that remains the backbone of how Britain views Europe. Mm.
And would ultimately bring Britain to war.
But before that, it demonstrated how the British would avoid a war. Mm-hmm. So in 1870, France and Prussia are gearing up for a war. And if you look at the map, it's obvious you go through Belgium, as the Germans did in 1914. But in 1870, the Prime Minister, Gladstone, who was no fan of war or expenditure, mobilized the fleet, mobilized 50,000 troops, many of them Royal Marines, and he sent them a stiff letter to Paris and Berlin. He said, look, if you cross the Belgian border, we are at war with you.
Simple. Oh, and we're advancing a little bit there, but that's a lesson that perhaps should have been learned in 1914.
Well, the great irony of 1914 is we have a liberal government, most of whose senior ministers had served under Gladstone. One of them had actually written the official life of Gladstone in three massive volumes. And in one of those volumes is all the information you need to understand how to deter great powers from invading Belgium. The account of the 1870 crisis is perfectly adequate to understand what they should have done in 1914. They don't even reference it.
And why do you think that is?
They have completely lost contact with the ideas that Wellington, Castlereagh, Liverpool started, that Palmerston and others carried on, and that Gladstone reluctantly but forcefully upheld in the 1870s and 80s when France and Russia looked like they were going to be a threat.
So he saw the value of that despite his instincts?
Yes, he didn't want to pay for it, but he knew that when push came to shove, they had to do this. Yeah. There's a crisis with the Russians 15 years later, and he does exactly the same thing. He mobilizes, he sends them a really stiff note, and they pull back. In 1914, this is not done. The Germans are allowed to think that the British will not act. And as a result, they march through southern Belgium, the great railway connection point at Liège. The British army had been modernized and mobilized as an expeditionary strike force. It's called the British Expeditionary Force, not the British Army. The expeditionary thing is important. Expedition is something you do and you come back. It's not an army of occupation. That was all set up in 1907-8 by the same government that would make such a mess of the 1914 crisis. The Secretary of State for War understood that British strategy was essentially maritime and it was about preventing threats emerging in Europe, and that was the job of the army.
And we'd seen that again and again, hadn't we, with the Cherbourg strategy. We'd seen it with the innovations that we've already spoken about with artillery, for example, of using massive force, but from a distance.
Yeah. So once the Scheldt estuary is not available for the French as an invasion base, they continue Louis XVI's ill-fated project at Cherbourg to build the world's largest artificial harbour, 60-odd miles from the Isle of Wight, as a permanent invasion threat. Napoleon revives it. The Bourbons carry on, the Orléans dynasty carry on, Napoleon III finishes it.
And he's very proud of it.
He's enormously proud of it, because he thinks it's going to do what it's meant to do, which is to keep the British on the defensive while France goes around Europe and creates a European system in its own image. And in 1858, it's all ready, and he stages a grand jamboree, and he gets Victoria and Albert to go along and have a look.
And interestingly, him and Albert speak in German, I believe. That's his original tongue, because he would have been Switzerland, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's brought up in German-speaking Switzerland, because he's an exile.
Yeah.
Nobody wants a Bourbon in France in this period. So the two men have that conversation. He's saying to the English, look at my amazing naval base, look at my amazing navy, look at how powerful we are. Let's make an agreement and then we'll sort Europe out and we'll make Europe look like we want it to.
Give me some respect.
It's very, very like. He's looking for support because he believes that his regime will only survive if he can do great things in Europe. And he isn't strong enough to do them on his own. The British just say, no, we're not interested in that. If there are problems in Europe, we will talk to you about how we resolve them, but we're not going to create them. We do not want to start a European war. We want to finish it. And the British had already used the French up. The Crimean War is a brilliant demonstration. 25,000 British troops and a French force that gets up to nearly 250,000 troops capture and destroy the Russian naval base at Sevastopol. While the Royal Navy is using its long-range power projection capabilities to knock down fortresses in the Baltic and threaten St. Petersburg. That's how the British think strategically. Take out the enemy's naval base, burn their fleet, control the sea, destroy their economy, and ultimately you will win. It won't be quick, and it might be expensive, but you've got a really good credit line with the City of London because you've been running down that national debt, you've been keeping up your payments, you've not done anything stupid economically. Therefore, you can go back and say, could I borrow some more money, please? And the big banks, including the European Rothschilds, will back you against everybody else.
And you don't get stuck there either, do you, with that,
no.
with that strategy? That's important to that.
Well, Britain has just about enough manpower to control its extra-European empire, although just is a very marginal word. What the British want is to control global trade, and global trade moves by sea. So ports, access to markets, communications dominance. So it's the British who set up transoceanic steamship lines to speed up communications. It's the British who lay global networks of cable telegraphs, which earn their corn every day, transmitting commercial information, but are also strategically vital. Britain is able to control the global movement of ships and military activity from the 1870s, essentially right around the world. By 1873-4, the telegraph goes all the way to Sydney, New South Wales. It goes out to Hong Kong. And by 1914, it goes right around the world. And it's all either under the sea, and where it comes ashore, that's British territory. So it's called the All Red Route. And it's something which is vital to two world wars.
And as well, ironically, to the emergence of the United States as a major power as well. And talking of major powers, there is one that emerges. We spoke of Prussia quite a bit. We haven't spoken Germany that much, which and that united Germany, which becomes the dominant continental power.
Yeah. There's a fundamental problem when we're looking at Germany. So, as I've been saying, France is unstable. There's a succession of leaders who are trying to achieve things which France literally cannot do. And so we get these proto-Napoleons cropping up, and they all fail. Germany is different. Germany is created by Prussia. It's an Eastern German military power. Its main concerns are the Russians and the Austrians. And it's been dragged closer to the Rhine after 1815, so it is a bit concerned with France. But France is not its major enemy. It's the Eastern powers. And under the first emperor, Wilhelm I, Germany is a stabilizing force, keeping Europe in a fairly static, rather conservative model, with France as the outrider that has to be managed. France is a republic. It's a dangerous revolutionary compared to the more stable monarchical states. But then first Kaiser's son, who inherits, dies without speaking a word. He has cancer of the throat, and he dies within months of taking the throne. He never says a word. He's Queen Victoria's son-in-law. Their son, Kaiser Wilhelm II, is Victoria's grandson. And unlike any self-respecting Prussian king, what he wants is a big navy, because his granny has one. And Germany goes from being a force for stability in Europe to being a force for chaos in the world. Germany aspires to be a world power, Weltpolitik, and the removal of Bismarck and the move towards a global power, the move towards building a navy to challenge the British. These are massively destabilizing elements. And what we find is in the 1890s, Britain is very worried about France and Russia, which become allies, but they're not really a threat because they don't support each other. When the British have a set to with the French about a bit of Africa, the Russians aren't nowhere to be seen. And vice versa, when the British and the Russians are arguing about Afghanistan, the French don't join in. So that alliance doesn't threaten Britain. It's because they're both frightened of Germany as a military power. The Germans, however, have destabilized all of this in their search for global power. So we have a new Napoleon. His name is Wilhelm. And he sets Germany on a course to either become a major hegemonic power or to collapse in ruins. And the British end up getting dragged into that war because they don't have the skill, the application, or the memory capacity to see how they could have dealt with more effectively.
You've addressed that memory capacity there when you talk about the liberal governments of the early 20th century. But also there's the nature of the Entente system that's there, that's relatively weak. This is between Britain and France and Russia, which is not an alliance.
No.
Can you explain the difference between an Entente? And I mean, it's secretive, basically, isn't it, an Entente?
Well, in the case of binding alliance, if you're ally is attacked, you are obliged to join in, and you don't have any discretion in this. It would be disgraceful to
back up. This is like Article 5, isn't it?
An entente is an agreement that all of your pre-existing disputes have been settled. You are on very good terms with this country, and in the event of a crisis, you will indeed consult with them. The Anglo-French entente is a way of balancing off Germany, which suits the French, and it suits the British, and it suits the Russians. The problem is that by 1914, Russia is rearming at a very rapid pace. And the German military is convinced that the Russian army, which is enormous, with its new field artillery, which is coming into service quickly, will be too strong for the German army as the ally of the French, that they won't be able to defeat both of those military powers. And that leads Germany to move towards what becomes a preventive war. If the British had an binding alliance with France, then the Germans would be certain that the British would join in that war. But they don't have a binding alliance, and that allows the Germans to believe that there's a very strong possibility the British won't turn up. Why would the British help the French? So the Kaiser, on the one hand, is a quarter English, but on the other hand, he doesn't see the world in the same way the British do. Mm. And the government of 1914 is profoundly anxious about what it thinks is the big issue of the year, which is home rule for Ireland.
Yeah, of course.
Its eye is completely off the ball. Asquith has no engagement with war and politics. The Foreign Secretary is trying to find a neat way to turn this into a policy. But the Navy is led by Winston Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty. And when the war finally breaks out, the British government has, A, done nothing serious to prevent it. This has not issued a single serious warning to the Germans. Not about France, about Belgium. So when the war actually starts and the Germans do march into Belgium, Churchill says, why don't we send the army to France? And all the generals applaud because they don't want to be an expeditionary force. They want to be a proper army, which is a serious problem because Britain doesn't need that kind of army. It needs a different kind of army. And nobody in the cabinet says, we shouldn't do that. So it happens. And we drift into a war, which is the very antithesis of everything that every British statesman of consequence had understood from the late 18th century until the turn of the 20th century. Yeah. This is not how Britain fights wars. Yeah. It has never done this before. And what happens in 1940 is we decide that we're not going to do this ever again. Yeah. And we withdraw and we engage the enemy in a classic British places, which is overseas at distance, where we can use our real strength, which is maritime and economic, to degrade the enemy before they even get to the battlefield. The war in the Western Desert in the Second World War is like the war in the West Indies in the 18th century. You cut off their communications and you can defeat them. And it's the Navy that reduces the enemy in North Africa to a state where the army can defeat them. They can't get enough fuel, they can't get resupply, they can't get equipment. And they're gradually degraded and defeated. That's where you fight the enemy. You don't fight them where they're strongest. That's very poor strategic thinking.
And without overdoing this, what lessons do you think there are? Here we are in 2025. We've seen, you've demonstrated that this remarkable system worked from 1815 to 1914, almost a century. It was envisioned and put into practice. This was not contingent in the main. It was something that was fought for and argued for and which took root and manifested itself. Worked by and large. What lessons do you think it has for today?
The first lesson is for people like me. We have to stop looking at events as if they matter and think about longer patterns. The long 19th century, 1793 through to 1914, starts with a total war, ends with a total war. We need to understand not how the battles were fought, or indeed in the micro sense, how the war was won. We need to look at the bigger underlying issues. Why do the British operate in the way that they do? How are they able to fund this war for 20-odd years? How are they able to fund the First World War for 4 and a bit years as well, when they're fighting with much larger level of commitment? So enormous resources being used unintelligently do not produce good results. So you need to have a strategy which identifies your critical interests. So in this book, the critical interest is keeping the bad guys out of Belgium. And of course, the bad guys get into Belgium, and it's U-boats and surface ships from Ostend and Zeebrugge that nearly defeat Britain. That was avoidable. Putting the British Expeditionary Force in Antwerp would have prevented that. And the German army is not going to march on Paris with an Anglo-Belgian army in northern Flanders, because the opportunity to attack their communications is so wide open. So it has several values. So not to look at the big events, not what happened at Waterloo, but what Waterloo means and how it fits into the evolution of Wellington's system. 1900, we've got the British attaché in Brussels talking about Wellington's system, that the British army will come and secure Antwerp, and that this is absolutely axiomatic. He then goes on to be the defence correspondent of the Times after he retires, and Lord Kitchener is reading his stuff, and yet he still says we should send the army to France. So we need to understand that we are a maritime power. It's not a reflection on the army to say that the Navy is the senior service, because we live on an island and we operate globally. And Britain could never focus on Europe in the way that Germany or France could, because it had so many other things.
And do you think that's understood today?
I'm not sure that anybody thinks about defence in the long term, security, and it's highly unlikely that there's any serious thought about how the defence feeds into international relations, feeds into international economic activity. Really simple thing. There's invariably a British frigate operating in the Persian Gulf, which is available to support British ships that are transiting that area against local opposition. Why? Because Britain is the centre of global shipping industry, and registering your ship in Britain has advantages. Mm. We need to think very carefully about how we build up the things that make us more effective, more resilient, more effective, particularly economically. And if you go back to the 18th, 19th century, if you wanted to operate globally with expensive ships, you came and insured them in London, you registered them in London, and you operated within the British system. And that gave you security. The Royal Navy's day-to-day job is maritime security. It's not war fighting, which is why it's at sea a lot, and it's doing a lot of interesting things other than getting ready for a war. Most navies don't do that. They just see themselves as preparing for conflict.
Yeah, yeah.
The Royal Navy is a different organization.
It's an inherited tradition.
Britain is a different country. Mm. And what we've done over the course of the 20th century is move towards being just another normal country, forgetting that we took 400 years to create a very different kind of country. And it was deliberate. The British deliberately moved out of Europe because they couldn't hold their European territories. They deliberately moved to a different strategic, economic, political model. They saw themselves in the lens of previous maritime powers and how they had used inclusive government, economic activity, naval power to carve out a different approach. If you go to the National Gallery, there's a great picture there by Turner. It's called Dido Building Carthage.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was painted in 1814 to celebrate the defeat of Napoleon, who invariably called the British shopkeepers and Carthaginians. He assumed that his Roman Empire would defeat the old Carthaginians over and over again, but he lost. And Turner painted that picture for the nation.
And he painted it for the National Gallery as well, didn't he?
And he demanded that it be hung in a particular space with other
people. Which is where it still is, I
which
believe.
Which it still is. Yeah. You can find it. And he was offered a lot of money for that painting. He never sold it. That was there for a purpose. And he understood that Britain is different. So if you look at his output, he paints Venice, he paints Carthage, he paints the Dutch Republic as a great sea power state. What's he doing? He's reminding us who we are and where we come from. And the loss of that connectivity with the cultural origins of who we are, the strategic, the economic, and the political origins. We don't get to be a democracy without being a sea power. Mm-hmm. We don't get to be a rich and prosperous nation without being a sea power. We don't get to spread our culture around the world. And you know, we have achieved a degree of cultural ubiquity in that sense. All of that comes from being a maritime player, not from being a normal continental style nation. So it's a choice that was made. It's a choice that I think has been not consciously unmade, but just carelessly forgotten.
I think that's true. And I think that shows very much the value of history as well and study. But history alone, as you suggest, is not enough. It depends upon the judgment that history informs too, which is crucial. I think you made this very clear in your book, Andrew. And thank you so much for talking to us. It's absolutely fascinating. And I strongly recommend that people read your book. It's called No More Napoleons, How Britain Managed Europe from Waterloo to World War One. It's published by Yale University Press. So thank you, Andrew Lambert.
Thank you.